This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It would take years for traditional sanctions to have the kind of effect on Vladimir Putin and his machine that this oil ban and the resulting curtailment of energy sales from Russia will have. They'll be bankrupt by July.
America loves to blame the president when gas prices are high, but the fact is the U.S. president has very little control over the price we pay at the pump. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to oil expert Daniel Dicker to discuss the politicization of gas prices, how Russia's invasion of Ukraine is rattling global prices, and, in a very useful lesson on the complex world of commodities, we learn how oil markets are not that dissimilar from buying hand-woven baskets in a Turkish bazaar. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Daniel Dicker. Dan is an energy expert, and folks can find his work at dandicker.com. Dan, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Well, thanks, Alex. Always good to talk.
It's been too long, and we'd love to get your insights into oil and gas industry happenings, and there haven't been happenings like this in quite some time with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Why don't we first talk about what's on everybody's mind? Why are gas prices so high, even though oil prices have kind of leveled off?
It's always hard for people to remember, but oil prices were already at a fairly significantly high level before stuff started happening in Ukraine. And that was a function of things I've spoken to you in the past about. And that was about, you know, an oil industry that had been decimated by low prices for five straight years. And, you know, the 500 bankruptcies, 600 bankruptcies that happened in the industry, and the true shortage of supply that kind of was created during those years, that all of a sudden made itself felt as the entire, you know, global economy was coming out of a pandemic. So what you have is you have a lot of pent up demand for fossil fuels. And you saw that first in a European energy crisis, well before anything started in Ukraine, that had been driving prices here in the United States and elsewhere, you know, already to $90, $95 a barrel.
Yes, and there's a lot of misinformation, disinformation going on. People don't necessarily know how this all works. So why don't you kind of spell it out? When oil prices went from $80 to $150 a barrel, all of a sudden, gas prices, like in my neighborhood in San Francisco, went from $4 to $5.50, $6 pretty quickly. And then we see that it's kind of settled back down around the $100 a barrel range, and yet gas prices still stay the same. So a lot of people say, well, the gas companies are just gouging us. But there's more to it than that, isn't there?
Yeah, and it gets very complex. But understand that, you know, the timeline of turning oil into gasoline and then getting it into pumps is not instantaneous. And therefore, some of the prices that are being reflected at the pumps are reflecting crude oil prices that are 2 weeks old already. And so, you know, when you see oil prices drop by $15 or $20 like they did this week, but you don't see prices go down at the pumps, I know it's a natural reaction to say, well, you know, we're getting gouged for gasoline. But the truth is that that's not the way it works. And in fact, it can't. I mean, the law really is very clear, and the markets are very clear in what, you know, gas companies, whether they're independent or they're from major oil companies or they're just distributors, can charge for gasoline, whether it's at you know, BP or an Exxon station, or it's from your local BJ's or Speedway, or, you know, a lot of these independent small gasoline service stations. It's not something that they can manipulate, you know, all that much. You know, 5 or 10 cents a gallon, yes, depending on additives or what they think the market can bear. But for the most part, you know, gasoline prices are the same for everybody, depending on what the market says they can charge.
It does seem a little suspicious, though, that they may take advantage of the window of news on the flip side. Yes, it takes 2 weeks, let's say, for the refining process and to get it from tanker to somebody's gas tank. But when we hear that Russia has invaded Ukraine and oil prices in the world and the global commodity markets reflect that, it doesn't take 2 weeks to go to your local Exxon station and find that the prices have gone up accordingly.
Yeah, I would say it's probably true. And anecdotally is probably as well as any way to say that, yeah, they probably do take a little bit of an advantage of some sort of news to make the price at the pump go up a little faster than it comes down. But as to whether this is, you know, really gouging or not, I would say it's the smallest part of the puzzle to worry about whether, you know, prices get raised at the pumps maybe 4 or 5 days or 3 or 4 days before they probably should get raised.
And one thing we definitely agree on is the politicization of gas prices. And Democratic and Republican presidents have been guilty of this since the oil crisis of 1973. But every president I can remember always refers to gas is as low as it's been in 5 years. But explain why the U.S. president does not have an effect on gas prices in general, and why it's toxic for politicians to be talking this way.
First off, oil companies don't set oil prices. Markets set oil prices. And that needs to be understood from both sides, the right and the left. Because if oil companies could set prices, I mean, we'd never see oil under $100 a barrel, would we? I mean, and we'd never see oil prices under $150 a barrel. There's always a certain amount of demand. It's not like you could raise the price. The price could be just about anything, well, almost anything, and a certain number of barrels would be sold because the world needs it to run. So if oil companies could control oil prices, they'd be certainly happy to sell half as much as they're selling now at 3 times the price if they could do that. They can't do that. Think of it like a Turkish bazaar where, you know, everybody who sells a certain product, let's call them like baskets, woven baskets, comes to the bazaar, and all the buyers who want to buy baskets come to the bazaar, and nobody knows beforehand what the price is going to be for those baskets. But you know that the sellers want to sell it for as much as they can, and the buyers want to buy it for as little as they can. I mean, that's human nature. The only thing that happens in these bazaars is that the dealing starts to happen. The negotiation starts to happen. That's what bazaars are. I bid this. You want to sell it for that. We come to an arrangement. Now imagine that, you know, all of these, you know, basket weavers come from all around the world. And, you know, while their cost to make baskets might be different, one guy might be able to make a basket for $2. Another guy might need $40 to make a basket. They all come to this market together. And you also have to assume that all the baskets are basically the same. Any basket maker's basket is as good as the next guy. You don't care which guy's basket you buy. It's all the same to the buyers. And they all go and they start making deals for baskets. Now, the difference is that everybody knows everybody else's deals. Everybody knows their negotiations. Everybody knows what price is being bid. Everybody knows what price is being offered. And sooner or later, what you get is you get an agreement, a balance between buyers and sellers where there is one price. That price is what we call a benchmark. And in general, that's how markets work. Everybody who's engaged with a market, whether they're a buyer or a seller, or if they're only trying to, you know, speculate on baskets, if they're looking to buy baskets cheaply so they can sell them more expensively, I mean, everybody who's engaged there is part of the process at what we call price discovery. You know, the sellers of this have as little to do with setting the price as the buyers do, the sellers being obviously oil companies, the buyers being, you know, all of us. So the bottom line is oil companies don't set oil prices, the market set oil prices. And, you know, generally things can change that benchmark price of oil, but oil companies don't have a lot of input. And even more importantly, governments have like zero input into that bazaar. They don't even show up. They only complain about it. That's all they do.
And to stay on the basket analogy, the absurdity of the politicization of this marketplace could be the mayor of the town comes in after all these basket prices have been negotiated and touts that the basket prices are as low as they've been in a few years, even though he had absolutely nothing to do with this negotiation.
Exactly. There's never been administration, Republican or Democrat, who didn't want the baskets to be cheap, okay? Because it is a political nightmare, generally, when a whole bunch of buyers of baskets who really need baskets, they can't live without baskets, have to pay a lot for baskets.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio, and I'm speaking to energy expert Daniel Dicker. We've talked before on this show about solutions to weaning ourselves off of oil, and you've said, you know, it's going to mean some pain for the most vulnerable populations ultimately, but you are not shy about, not advocating for, but seeing $300 a barrel oil as a possible solution, a painful one, but a possible one. Why don't you expand?
I don't know if I put a number on it, but what we need to do in these markets is we have to start. If we're going to get to renewables, we have to start with the stability of the basket sales. Because 1 year we come out and baskets are selling for, you know, $30. And 1 year we come out and baskets are selling for $110. And, you know, and 1 year we come out and it's selling for $150. Then a week later, it's $90. And, you know, that's just no way to run a basket shop. You can't figure out how you get from oil to gas to solar to hydrogen without having a stabilized and a dependable oil market first. Because what happens is when oil markets are really, really low, nobody cares about making that next step to gas and renewables because why should I? I can fill my tank basically for nothing, and I can run my house with, you know, $2 natural gas, and I don't need solar because I'm perfectly happy to pay these very tiny prices. Then you get like a situation we have now where oil companies, because prices were so low, are incapable of responding to demand for new oil, and then we get prices that are very, very, very high, and then we have crisis. We have the entirety of Europe that's screaming for energy of any kind. Otherwise, they can't run their economies and people freeze. And that's what's going to happen in Europe right now. You can guarantee it. They're going to have no choice as much as it's anathema for Europe. They're going to be forced to burn a lot more oil, a lot more coal, and a lot more natural gas than they ever planned on doing because they don't have access to the amount of energy that they need to keep, you know, their recovery going, their economies going, and particularly now that they've shunned Russian supplies from their marketplace, or are trying to shun Russian supplies going forward.
So, Dan, let's get into the weeds a little bit more about Russia and Ukraine. Why don't you put Russia's role in the oil and gas industry into context for Americans? And it really is much more significant for the Europeans, as you've mentioned earlier in our conversation, right?
Right. First of all, Russia is the number one, at least the number one natural gas supplier in the world, number three for oil. They're a very significant part of the global energy chain in fossil fuels. That, of course, impacts Europe the most, and obviously to the east, China and India are big buyers of Russian oil and gas. What's important to note is that, you know, we're number two in natural gas and number one in oil production. And, you know, our economy is about 13% oil and gas. For Russia, it's closer to 45% oil and gas. So you must understand that Russia is, for all intents and purposes, a petrostate. They rely upon oil and gas revenues in order to survive. In fact, they rely upon oil and gas revenues in order to invade other countries. The tanks that are rolling through Kiev right now were bought with euros. The yachts that the United States and other European countries are targeting with sanctions were bought with euros. Euros that were sold via oil and gas to Europeans. And when you look to inflict the most damage that you possibly can and have the most impact you possibly can, short of military action, which of course is unfathomable for good reasons that Biden clearly understands, then what you want to do is target Russia's machine of oil and gas, which has been Biden's masterstroke, and his ability to not only get the UK to go along with this because they're a little more beholden on Russian supplies, but also to get the Europeans to start a very, very serious conversation on how they can divest themselves and supplant Russian energy supplies. It puts the kind of hurt on Russia that sanctions alone could never, 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 never do. It would take years for traditional sanctions to have the kind of effect on Vladimir Putin and his machine that this oil ban and the resulting curtailment of energy sales from Russia will have. They'll be bankrupt by July, which is the reason, the main reason, in my view, that they are talking seriously with Ukraine right now, with the prospects that there might even be a deal on the table. I saw from FT today, possible deal in the works between Russia and Ukraine. This is an impossible outcome from what was happening 2 weeks ago. And I think if it does happen, Biden will solidify himself as the finest leader of the free world, the greatest president we've seen in 60 years, for having found the opportunity here and had the courage, despite the fact that it is a political nightmare normally to knowingly make gas prices go up, which is what he's done, and found a way to isolate the Russians to this degree such that, you know, we're really looking at, hopefully, soon a cessation of hostilities in Ukraine.
Clean this mess up, else we'll all end up in jail. Those test tubes and a scale, just get it all out of here. Is there gas in the car? Yes, there's gas in the car.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio, and I'm speaking to energy expert Daniel Dicker. People can follow his work at dandicker.com. So, Dan, you mentioned state-run oil companies. Let's look at some of the reaction from the Russian behemoths, namely Gazprom and Lukoil. I saw a news story recently that Lukoil has condemned the invasion by Russia into Ukraine. So Lukoil is working with the Iraqis to expand production in its largest field, West Qurna 2. What does that mean in terms of the global marketplace? Is it enough for Lukoil just to condemn what the Russian government is doing in Ukraine? How independent is a company like Lukoil, I guess, is the question.
They're not very independent. You've got to remember that the Russians, for the most part, need Western technology and Western expertise to get their more difficult resources out of the ground. And they've relied upon partnerships with Western oil companies in order to do that for the last several decades. What has been to give Western oil companies a pat on the back, those Western oil companies were some of the first industries to leave Russia when the invasion began in Ukraine. BP ran away from assets worth $25 billion on the second day of the invasion with absolutely no hope, or at least they no professed hope to get back any of the investment. And that's a lot considering their market cap is $100 billion. It's 25% of their market cap. Exxon ran away from the Sakhalin gas project. Shell ran away. Total ran away. Equinor ran away. So this is Western expertise supporting in a way that I've never seen in my lifetime.
Yes, I mean, when you say run away, that's these are major investments, not just in dollars, but also manpower, and they've taken years to develop. And then on a dime, these companies have pivoted away from these projects.
I'm glad you said it, because I, in my lifetime, I never would have thought I would have seen that from oil companies. These are not companies that normally have a very strong moral compass. They're perfectly happy dealing with corrupt governments that are run by authoritarians and butchers. They've done it for a long, long time. I mean, that just happens to be where the oil is. And for them to respond, mostly as European and American companies, to this call to sanction Russia is just remarkable, just incredible. You know, I can't describe just how incredible it is. And in terms of hurting Russia where it counts, and why a lot of these Russian oil companies are searching for other sources of oil, is because this kind of retreat from Western oil companies from the Russian oil production scene is something that will hurt them in a way that all the Starbucks and the McDonald's in the world can't hurt Russia. So I wanted to point that out, and I do that at every opportunity, because normally from the left, which is basically your audience, I mean, oil companies are the devil, and they're looking to gouge you and destroy and take advantage. And, you know, there's a lot of truth to that. But in this particular case, you know, give them a pat on the back. They've really stepped up and supported Europe in their fight against, you know, this authoritarian who wants to wreak, you know, havoc, death, and destruction throughout much of Eastern Europe.
Well, when I hear Americans complaining about gas prices, I like to remind them that we've been paying subsidized, very cheap rates for so many decades. A lot of this is because of the politicization of gas prices in the body politic. But sure, you can go to some of the more densely populated parts of Europe, and they have public transport and other alternatives for people when they're charging $8, $9 a gallon for gas. That seems like that people have options. But Canada is a very big oil producer. They pay $8 a gallon, and it's a pretty big country and rural as well. I'm sure Canadians are just, they've already kind of built that in to their calculus. Americans have not realized that gas should cost something. What can we do to reach the American consumer's mindset more effectively, Dan?
There, you know, look, this has been a long-standing issue with me for 20 years, where, you know, the mostly from the right touted the idea of the U.S. being energy independent, that somehow if we could just pump enough oil, you know, we'd have $2 gasoline in unlimited quantity forever.
They just need to open up more Arctic wilderness for drilling. You always see that coming out, right?
It's always been nonsense. Every time oil prices spike, I hear this crap from the right. They generally bring up Keystone XL, which has been a dead project since 2009. It's a project that nobody cares about. Nobody in Canada would even want if they could have it now. It's like one pipeline is going to make the difference in terms of supply. You cannot isolate this country from the global energy markets. Okay. You just cannot do it. I don't care how much you pump. Oil is going to find its way, like in the bazaar, to the guy who's willing to pay the most for it. All right. And if your guys in the United States, unless you want, a purely state-run energy business, which you can do, but that's really communist. I mean, talk to the right about that. You really want $2 gas forever? Now you're really talking communism, okay? And it's been the same story from them for 25 years. Every time gas prices spike with a Democrat in office, it's because, you know, the left is at war with fossil fuel producers. And I keep telling them, you know, it's the markets are the markets. And whoever's in office at the time is either the lucky guy or the unlucky guy. And Biden just happened to be the unlucky guy. Trump was no fan of oil companies either. Under his watch, 600 oil companies went broke. Literally 600 went broke. So he was no big fan of oil companies, or at least he wasn't an advocate. He didn't help them from going bankrupt. All of these very short, quick kind of discussions from the right and from the left, as often and as loud as I can, I tell this country, you really should grow up. You guys should really grow up. You are not entitled as a birthright to $2 gas forever. And in fact, that kind of attitude is helping to destroy the planet, slow down the transition, and really take it out of the environment. It's time for us to take our responsibility seriously in a global energy market. And as you say, like in Canada and Europe and the rest of the world, that isn't, you know, controlled by state-run oil companies, pay a reasonable price for a gallon of gas.
Dan Dicker, thanks so much for being my guest on SeaChange Radio.
Always a pleasure, Alex. Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to SeaChange Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Lee Johnson, David Bowie, and Steely Dan. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to SeaChange Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For SeaChange Radio, I'm Alex Wise.